The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is the Reverend Dr. Samuel Wells. Dr. Wells is vicar of St. Martin in the Fields in London. He served as dean of the Duke University Chapel and research professor of Christian ethics at Duke Divinity School in Durham, North Carolina from 2005 to 2012. He has written numerous books and articles, including the book Improvisation, The Drama of Christian Ethics. Dr. Wells was ordained in the Church of England in 1991. Sam, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
I am thrilled to get to talk to you, and there's so much I'd like to cover, but in the spirit of improvisation, I thought I would start our conversation with a quote I found when doing some research on ethics, and it's from the writer Salman Rushdie, and he says, "It is often said by religious people that without the framework, there is no sense of right and wrong. My view is that religion comes after ethics."
Yeah, I think that would be a fairly contemporary view, and actually it was a view that Dietrich Bonhoeffer made when he lived in New York just before he went back to Germany, where of course he met his death during the Second World War. I think he observed that that was, you know, what he, I don't think he used this phrase, but the American way, mm-hmm. that Americans tend to think of ethics first and then religion or theology as that which furnishes us with ethical intentions and commitments. I would take a slightly different view, which is that you can't really separate the two. Mm-hmm. Theology is the way God relates to us. Ethics is the way we relate to one another and to God. Right. For me, particularly as a Christian, because of the incarnation, because of Jesus being fully human and fully divine, I think the days when we can disentangle those two are gone.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I was profoundly moved by your book on improvisation and Christian ethics, in part because it was such an unexpected way to look at two topics that I had felt I had already knew a lot about, but as is true about so much, I quickly learned there's a lot I don't know. And early in the book, you offer that, quote, "The Bible is not so much a script that the church learns and performs as it is a training school that shapes the habits and practices of a community." Talk to us about that.
Well, the theologian George Lindbeck talked about three kinds of religion. He used rather grand language, which I'll try and simplify, but he talked about what he called cognitive propositional, which was the pre-modern view that the Bible gave us a series of propositions and more or less of factual statements mm-hmm. about the world, and that they were comparable to the ones that Aristotle and the Greeks and Romans had given us too, and that there was a kind of a united world. And a lot of people still see religion in that way, as a series of claims, truth claims, they're sometimes said. And then from the post scientific era onwards, in other words, from the 17th century onwards, people started to think in what Lindbeck calls experiential expressive ways. In other words, they evaluated religion by what it meant to their heart and how they managed to live it out. So it was very much the turn to the subject, as the philosophers call it. People, you know, we become the measure of all things rather than an external reality. And then, but then what Limbeck's proposing is a kind of a third turn, which is inspired by Wittgenstein, the philosopher, which is to turn to seeing religion more about as along the lines of a language and a culture, as a series of rules and guidelines that we live within, and a way of speaking and a way of imagining the world. And then he and others in particular, have then conceived of that, particularly in terms of narrative. So in other words, Christianity becomes a story that we enter. And then in my book, I talk about the way we enter that story in Act 4 of a 5-act play. And that's kind of what I'm describing in that quote that you just used. I can go on to it, say more about that if you'd like me to.
Yeah, well, and what is very interesting to me, because I think the improvisational door you walked through was based on Keith Johnstone's work, right? The book Impro.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Keith Johnstone was very much. What happened was that I was in the first year of doing my doctoral studies, and I was reading about people like Lindbeck. In fact, I just read Lindbeck's book, and I was reading about people in that kind of theology and exploratory. And then I read Johnston's book, and I thought, hang on. I thought two things straight away. Number one, this is the same stuff. And
right.
Number two, nobody else has noticed that this is
nope.
the same stuff.
No, they haven't.
I had a PhD.
Yeah. And what's so interesting about that for me is, and Johnstone is wonderful and very story-based, which your book as well, the precursor to Johnstone is Viola Spolin, who is basically where all Second City comes from. So there's sort of three major schools of improvisation.
And, okay.
and the thing about Spolin is it's all behavioral-based. So, you know, she was a social worker at Jane Addams Hull House on the south side of Chicago in the 20s and 30s, working with immigrant children, trying to find ways to better assimilate them. So she created all these improvisation games, many of which were gibberish or not language-based at all, because the kids didn't share language, and some did. But what they did was promoted empathetic behaviors. They created a sense of community and a sense of collaboration. Her son, Paul Sills, was studying at the University of Chicago with his friends Mike Nichols and Elaine May. They formed the first improvisational theater in America in 1955, the Compass Players, which then turns into the Second City in 1959. And you fast forward many years, you know, and I've been at Second City, my wife and I, for 30 years, and you start to discover that, you know, these, it's almost a return to the roots, where really what it is a practice. And you use that term. You talk about practices and a practice of discipleship inside your book. And I was just sort of fascinated that so few people have made this connection, and you found it, you know, and your book was written, you know, quite a while ago as well.
Yeah, 2000, early 2000s, published in 2004. But actually, I had the ideas in the first half of the 90s, I'd
wow.
say. And they just took a while to take book form. But, I mean, the word practice is very much a word which, for philosophers, it was associated with Alistair MacIntyre and his book After Virtue in 1981. And then in theological terms, with Stanley Hauerwas, who was the person about whom I wrote my PhD and with whom I've become, you know, closely associated and written books together and so on. And a practice is the kind of human activity that arises out of conscious participation in a narrative.
Right.
And it's very closely aligned to habit.
Yeah.
So, you know, practice and habit. And of course, you know, as soon as I use words like that, then suddenly you're straight into improvisation.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess, you know, one of the central stories in the improvisation book is where I talk about this this conversation about why a medical procedure went wrong, and the two friends have a big disagreement about it. One says, "Oh, it's terribly unfortunate the boy died on the operating table." The other one says, "It's not unfortunate at all. It's it all goes back to when this man was a medical student, and he was playing golf all the time and missed all the lectures, and he should have known the difference between the weight of chloroform and ether. And because he didn't, the reason he didn't was he was on the golf course, and because he didn't, the boy died."
Right.
And so that's all about the formation of character through practice and habit, you know, 20 years before. And it's kind of by the time, and So the crucial breakthrough for me was to recognize that in the ethics I was writing about, there was a movement of, you know, known as virtue ethics, which, you know, the central tenet of which was to say ethics isn't about making decisions. Well, a whole generation of ethics, including situation ethics, had taken for granted it was about making decisions. But what this virtue ethics was pointing out was that, you know, these dilemmas may be very, you know, the classic sort of the submarine sinking and who's using up the most oxygen and the overweight man, maybe we have to kill him for the to get the others nine out the pipe. That kind of scenario, which probably not me nor any of your listeners have actually found themselves in, but still fascinated ethicists for a couple of decades. And was also the way I was introduced to ethics, you know, wasn't the issue. The interesting questions were, you know, where was the submarine going and why were they on it and who were they? And, you know, you can't address decision. Of course, that's just the same as saying improvisation isn't actually just about spontaneity. It's all about formation and narrative, you know, that goes back a long time so that when you do find yourself in a crisis, you've already learned to take the right things for granted, so you don't even realize that you're taking a decision because it sort of comes naturally.
Right, and I love this quote that you have, which you talk about, you know, years of steeping in a tradition so that the body is so soaked in practices and perceptions that it trusts itself in a community to do the obvious thing. And this is the unthinking aspect of improvisation. So you know what you do is you try not to be so much in your head, and you can't be when you're improvising because you're making it up as you go along. But you're drawing on ideas, inspirations, characters, knowledge, and behaviors that will allow a scene to move forward. And what we teach is, you know, that can't be negative, right? To move a scene forward, you can't live in no, you have to live in yes and. You have to live in an affirm and contributing mindset. And to me, there's a very easy draw there between the habits of people who are ethical rather than just a knowledge transfer of this is what's right and this is what's wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, and I can quote you this part of Johnston because it's written on my heart, and I haven't got the book in front of me, and I haven't looked at the book for quite a long time, but I can still quote you this line. There are people who like to say yes and people who like to say no, and those who say yes are rewarded by the adventures they have, and those who say no are rewarded by the safety they attain.
Yeah.
That is just part of my personal scripture.
It's yeah, absolutely.
Written on my heart, and you know, I'm determined to be a person that says yes, and that means sometimes not the safety so much.
No, absolutely. And you know, this always when we talk about improvisation, people ask me, you know, why and how Second City has taken this into, you know, corporate environments and other educational environments. Mm-hmm. And what I often say is, really, this work is about groups of people making something out of nothing at its most basic. And a common theme here is sort of the understanding of what connectedness means. And I was reading a piece you wrote called Rethinking Service. And you write about humanity has long believed that mortality was our biggest issue. And you asked the question, what if it turned out that the fundamental human problem was actually isolation?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, just before 5 minutes before speaking to you, I've been speaking to 300 homeless support workers. Hmm. Talking about exactly that same point, that the point that I was making with them was the irony that the real problem with homelessness isn't lack of resources, isn't lack of care workers, isn't, you know, all these kind of things. Everyone wants the government to give it more money. Of course they do. It's isolation from, yeah, you know, and the inability to sustain relationships. And the irony I was trying to point out to the homeless support workers is the reason we were having this big conference and hosting them was because they go through the same experience too.
Sure.
You know, they're isolated too. So to me, that insight is fundamental to my social thought. That another way that I put it, I think also in that article, is you know, that the most significant word in theology and ethics is with.
Yeah.
But actually with is the key word. And you know, improvisation is, a lot of it is about keeping the story going, and in other words, maintaining the relationship.
Right. and you talk about two, the counter of that is four, right? So we talk a lot about doing things for people, which is, you know, a very seemingly noble and smart thing. But, you know, much more powerful is to be with people.
Well, one of the great distinctions I found was from the philosopher Gabriel Marcel, who distinguishes between a problem and a mystery. So a problem is something generic. You've seen 100 of them before. It's like a plumber fixing a faucet. You know, you learned this in plumber school, and the key word in relation to problem is fix. Whereas a mystery, you've never seen before. They're sui generis. There's never been another of these in the world. And you can't walk around the outside of them and make a decide, you know, like a surgeon deciding where to make the incision. You actually have to walk into them and see them from the inside. And of course, you know, again, what I was saying to the homeless support workers is the guys you're working with on the streets, all the other agency treat them as a problem. You're treating them as a mystery.
Right. Yeah, and it becomes so true in the sense that, you know, the ills of the world, right, are so massive, and you know, there's so many people trying to do good, and you start to think we need radical solutions, and maybe the radical solution is stop trying to do for and start doing with, be with folks,
and start thinking about the word solution. I mean, because I mean that's something that improvisation has taught me, a way that's taught me to think is because there's something about four which actually both controls and concludes the narrative, whereas there's something about with that says, you know, it's not actually a big deal where we go.
It's
I mean, going back to your point about corporates, I mean, the Harvard guru, you know, business guru Ron Heifetz, I don't know if you come across him, but you know, he talks about the difference in leadership between the challenge for the gorillas of the leopard, and the hierarchy that develops amongst the gorillas to respond to the leopard, you know, who's the wisest and the strongest and so on. And then along comes somebody with a gun, and that hierarchy then has to change, and then they have to work out what of what's worked to survive against the leopard they need to keep, what they need to jettison because it's irrelevant to the gun, and what they need to find from their history that they didn't need to survive against the leopard, but they need to survive against the gun. And that is improvisation.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if anyone's whispered that in his ear, but that is what he then, you know, he sells millions of books and gets the big bucks for telling business people this stuff about the gorilla. And it's very good.
Yeah.
However, it's all in Johnston, really.
Right. And because the truth changes. And I think, you know, we're so, you know, once we find a truth, you know, we're like, oh, thank God I found this truth. But the reality, that changes all the time. And so the ability to pivot, the ability to be agile. And I want to tie this to your writing and some of your thoughts on marriage, because indeed, I think more people probably understand how a successful marriage is being with someone as opposed to being for someone, whereas extending that out to bigger groups, they maybe don't make that leap. And one of the things I just love that you said, which is about marriage, is it's a constancy that runs through mistakes, misunderstandings, and failures, which is such an improv thing.
Very much so. And I mean, I talk about the three faces of marriage. I don't know if you picked this up in the same place.
Yeah.
There's the face-to-face, which obviously physical, attractive, direct encounter, eyeball to eyeball, the side-by-side, which is the, you know, making dinner together, bringing up kids together, and the back-to-back, which is, you know, when you're both at your separate workplace, for example, and those kinds of things. And that, I don't know many marriages that work on all three of those levels, but as I say in that piece, in the words of the great philosopher Meatloaf, two out of three ain't bad, and you make up, and that's where the improvisation comes. You make up for the deficiencies in one area through the enjoyment of the other two.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that we have a Meatloaf reference. So, you know, midway through the conversation, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
The other thing that was interesting, and this was a video you did when you were at Duke, and you were being talked to about the Defense of Marriage Act, right? Which was, you know, I think in 2012, 2013.
Yeah.
And I love a phrase you said, which is, the marriage I believe in needs no legal defense.
Mm. Well, and also I find it rather bizarre that you should regard as your great enemies the people that want to join your institution.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's quite an irony in that.
There is. And the other sort of piece of wisdom that I had not thought of from a sort of normalization aspect was, because you mentioned that the idea of future marriage is fairly commonly accepted in social circles in the United States across many religions and many, basically the wide swath of our country. Yet there's really no justification in the New Testament for further marriage. But society has come around.
In terms of marriage after divorce, yeah. Absolutely. And that is, I mean, as a church person, as a person in a denomination where this is, where gay marriage or same-sex marriage is a very controversial thing at the moment. I think that's, that's what I always say. Well, you show me where in the New Testament we get this this clear mandate for further marriage after divorce. Mm-hmm. And then, then let's have a conversation. But you can't pick and choose these things. The church has found a way. And, I remember back in the early 80s, it looked like this could be a really real deal breaker.
Right.
I haven't had a conversation about this with anybody for decades.
No,
nobody's interested. It's we've moved on. We've said things like, well, divorce happens, and often actually it can be the right thing even for the church. But people say these things as a matter of course now. But everyone understands that divorce makes life complicated or recognizes the complications already in life. Well. Most, not all of those things, but most of the things I've just said, apply in the case of same-sex attraction and same-sex relationships. That, they are here, whether you celebrate them or whether you find them difficult, they are here, and they can be beautiful. And it's not as if heterosexual marriage is a panacea for everything. It's not a picnic. There's a lot of chaos out there.
Sure.
And here are people faithfully seeking to make as beautiful as they can the circumstances of their life. And when you're looking for enemies to find, that's a very strange place to start.
Well, and when people ask me in improvisation, what's the number one problem with people when they're improvising or if they have problems doing it and they can't do it? And I say it's fear. It is completely 100% fear of failure, fear of shame. And when I think of why we're in that conversation, is people are scared. They're scared of of the other and what's different and how it reflects upon them. And there needs to be actually understanding and appreciation for that fear. So a lot of early improvisational exercises are all about breaking down those fears, allowing yourself to look foolish, allowing yourself to express ideas that maybe aren't your own, which then promote empathy and the ability to engage with others in powerful new ways.
Well, life is largely about making honest mistakes. I think there's a significant portion of the church on both sides of the Atlantic that actually, have got to the place where they see a change around these issues as inevitable, even if they don't celebrate it. Mm-hmm. But there's a profound fear that we're going to make a kind of mistake with a capital M.
Right.
And, life is about making interesting mistakes and faithful mistakes and learning from them. It's not about, there's a parable about that. There's a parable about the slave that buried the talent because he was terrified he might make a mistake.
Hmm.
He didn't get a good reviews.
No. And one of the key tenets of improvisation is make mistakes work for you. See
exactly,
all
yeah.
obstacles and, as gifts.
And that's the fun, yeah, exactly. Hmm. I mean, it's the word gift. I mean, this is, I've become convinced that this issue around same-sex attraction and relationships and marriage is one of the ways that we've been given in our generation. Not like, a whole bunch of people wouldn't have chosen that on either side of the debate, on either side of the identity issues.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we've been given to demonstrate to one another and to the world what it means to be the church.
Yep, yep. There's a improv exercise that we use a lot, and I was actually attending a workshop the other day, and it dawned on me that it's something that you talk about as well. So we do this with corporate groups a bunch, and it's called thank you statues. And the simple idea is that two people carry on a conversation, but they each have to begin every sentence with the words thank you. And we do that because it fundamentally shifts the orientation of the conversation, not only for the person who is getting, you know, thank you said to them, but the person who is saying thank you. And you actually talk about it as an art, that there's an art to saying thank you.
Yeah, very much so. Very, very much in the way that you've conceived. And one of the big sort of theological insights that this gave me was in terms of understanding what's meant by reconciliation. Hmm. That, you know, people walk away, you know, people hate conflict.
Right.
And they get very frustrated with conflict in the church because they somehow feel that, you know, if Jesus has made everything all right, there shouldn't be any conflict. So you're obviously irrational and stupid, otherwise there wouldn't be a conflict. Mm-hmm. Or they think this is taking up a huge amount of time that should be spent. The phrase usually begins going out and then people complete that sentence with whatever social issue they think is, or evangelistic issue is that, you know, is the most pressing on their heart or whatever part of the world. And what I realized through exactly this philosophy of thank you, which is that actually there isn't anything other than reconciliation. Mm-hmm. That's actually all there is. All there is making mistakes and turning those into opportunities and gifts. There's nothing else in life. You know, we sort of think in a marriage or in a parent-child relationship or in a friendship or in an institution, you know, these other guys across the road, they must be having a great time because they never seem to argue or whatever. You know, those are simply people that haven't drawn on the resources of their mistakes and tensions and conflicts and found a way to bring those back into the relationship or the institution. They're heading for trouble.
Right, and more likely they're not even talking about it, right? I mean, they have.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
And I mean, not talking about it is not using, you know, the past experience and drawing that back into. I mean, you know, reincorporation is just crucial. Another of Johnston's lines, which, you know, is very close to my heart, is improvisation is like a person walking backwards. Hmm. And we, you know, we look into the future and we despair because we don't know what to do in the future. Well, that's because we're looking in the wrong place. We should be looking at the discarded materials from the past. That's where to reincorporate those. I mean, I guess those are ways in which improvisation has become so part of my almost instinctive approach to life, theology, thinking in general, that I don't even realize that my insights are actually rooted in an improvisational way of thinking.
Right. And the connection of what we've talked about, where we talk about mistakes and we talk about community, is summed up in a phrase from Second City in our work, which is we've all heard the term you're only as good as your weakest member as part of a team. Mm. And we change that, which is you're only as good as your ability to compensate for your weakest member, which then puts the onus back on the entire group to lift up the individual, because at any time, one of us is going to be the weakest member.
Well, and also I've been very influenced by the work of John McKnight, and his language of asset-based community development. And again, starting with people's assets rather than their deficits.
Right.
You know, I would really wonder about the definition of the weakest member.
Yes.
You know, because you, that's all about deficit. Mm-hmm. You know, that's probably the most different member whose assets are not the regulation ones. And, you know, Watership Down is a wonderful novel. Mm-hmm. Where each of the escaping rabbits ends up playing a crucial role in the redemption of the whole group of rabbits, including the weakest member, who at their darkest hour tells them stories.
Right.
And, you know, as they're going to sleep the night before battle kind of thing. So, you know, it turns out that every rabbit has a crucial thing to contribute. And, you know, the way I transpose that into contemporary church and society is to say that, you know, the church has for far too long, I won't put a date on it, but for far too long neglected and even rejected the gifts of the people on the edge of society. Mm. And then it has experienced its life as scarcity. Well, whose fault is that?
Right, right.
You know, it hasn't found a way to incorporate those whom society has rejected. If it did, there wouldn't be any problem, you know, because the gifts are all being given. It's just not looking in the right place for them and not using them when they come its way.
Yeah, it's hard to look inside the cracks, and I think what we've learned is there was a phrase that we have too, which is nuance isn't everything. Nuance is everything else. And you know that there's a real power in looking at that. And I love this conversation. It's such an unlikely conversation to have. I'm sitting here in Chicago, a Second City guy, talking to a vicar who's referenced Meatloaf and Watership Down, which is just fantastic. And we're coming to sort of the end of our conversation. And as part of that, one of the things that we talk to all the different people that come on the podcast is there a yes and moment in your life, a time when you would have said no normally, but you didn't just say yes, you said yes and you found yourself in something, you know, completely new. And it doesn't have to be good, doesn't have to be bad. It you know, where were you? Did you have a yes and moment that you can tell us about?
Well, it's always best to say the first thing that comes into your head, isn't
yep.
it?
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that comes into my head was, you don't play a lot of squash in America, you tend to play racquetball. But I on about the 17th of December 2004, I was having a game of squash with my regular squash partner, and we had a drink afterwards and talking about some projects I was working on. And out of the blue, he said to me, would you ever work in America?
Hmm.
And I said, no. And a week later, I got a letter saying, would I come and be the Dean of Duke Chapel? And actually, I was quite ill for a couple of weeks, and so I hardly even opened the envelope. I was in bed and sick for a while. Anyway, on about the 7th of January or thereabouts, I called my wife on a Tuesday morning and said, I've just been reading Isaiah 49, and it says, it's too small a thing that I call you to the people of Israel. I've called you as a light to the nations. And I said, and something happened to me when I read that. And she said, do you know what? I was reading that this morning as well.
Wow.
And we went to America, and we never regretted it for one moment.
Yeah, was that, I'm curious about that. You know, you land, had you visited America before?
Well, no, I'd said I'd never work in America. I mean, I was actually born in Canada.
Okay.
And she, my wife had worked for 3 years in Minnesota when she was just out of, when she was in doing her master's.
Wow.
But as far as I was concerned, it wasn't something I'd given any thought to at all. And so, you know, I got the letter. I thought, haha, you know, how funny, how flattering, people write and occasionally offer you jobs. That's nice.
Yeah.
But then I read that passage and I thought, this is a yes. I mean, the reasons for saying no, I just don't stack up. They're not the good part of me. You know, they're the place of fear and conservatism and, you know, and just keeping things steady and not being overwhelmed. And, let's do this out of place of yes.
I love it.
And, you know, and as Johnston promised, we were rewarded by the adventures we had.
Yeah, that's a great place to end. Sam, thanks so much for joining us on Getting to Yes And.
It's been great to talk to you, Kelly.
Well, I've been working in a-